from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this next hour of Forum, Secretary of Homeland Security Kirstjen Nielsen has resigned, and we'll find out what her departure may mean for President Trump's immigration policy. But first, thousands gathered in Caracas on Saturday to call for the resignation of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro as the country reels from widespread blackouts, hyperinflation, and food, medicine, and water shortages. We'll talk about how the U.S. and the international community are responding and what's next for Venezuela. And that's next after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Thousands of supporters of Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido gathered in Caracas Saturday to demand that President Nicolas Maduro resign. The protests came amid a worsening political and humanitarian crisis in Venezuela as citizens cope with a collapsed health system and dire food, water, and electricity shortages. They also came as the United States imposed a new round of sanctions Friday targeting oil companies that the United States says are propping up Maduro's regime. Joining me first to talk about the ongoing crisis there is Scott Smith. He's a correspondent for the Associated Press, reporting from Caracas. Welcome, Scott Smith. Good to have you with us.
Michael, good to be with you.
I guess the place I'd like to begin, Scott, is just by finding out how much these demonstrations are making a difference to the Maduro regime. They seem to be increasing. There seems to be more anger at the Maduro regime and certainly more effort by the United States and others to essentially see to it that that regime is overthrown and that Guaido, who they feel was actually elected instead of Maduro under a fair, under an unfair election, that he should be in charge. I'm just asking you, how much really has have things increased to the point where Maduro is really under threat here?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. Really, since the beginning of the year, early, January, end of January, Juan Guaido, the head of the National Assembly here in Venezuela, you know, announced he was assuming presidential powers and bent on ousting Maduro. And one of his strategies, as you mentioned, has been, you know, drawing people into the street and demanding, you know, change and putting pressure on the Maduro government. And here we are, two, 3 months later after, you know, pretty much a weekly protest in the streets with thousands of people demanding Maduro step down. And yet here we are, and Maduro is still very much in place.
And how much have things, I'm sorry, I was just going to ask you, how much have things increased in terms of the crisis there? I mean, you know, there are more blackouts, it seems. There's more shortages going on and more hyperinflation.
Yeah, the crisis continues to spiral, you know, you could argue by the day or certainly by the week, you know, that we've just experienced several days of blackouts, which blanketed most of the country in, you know, power outages, which meant people didn't have water to drink. People couldn't make phone calls across town. A lot of people have relatives who live abroad, so they couldn't make phone calls to their relatives to let them know that they're okay. The crisis is very much, got a grip on Venezuela. The situation is not improving.
And how much do you believe Maduro is staying in power because of the help of Russia and China?
Yeah, well, they are certainly backing up Maduro and making sure that he remains in power. Those two countries that you name are, you know, heavily invested in Venezuela. Venezuela has a lot of debt it owes to Russia and China especially. They're involved in Venezuela's oil production, and they're interested in, you know, maintaining Maduro in power. You know, a key player here, too, we shouldn't overlook is the role of the military in this. Guaido early on made a real push to lure the military, the armed forces, you know, the soldiers, rank and file, to join his cause, and they seem to have remained firmly behind Maduro, which is really a linchpin to to turning events here, which, you know, the military is very much behind Maduro at this point as well.
So, yeah, Maduro is doing a lot for the military, I mean, in terms of what he's providing for them. And you mentioned the military and the role of the Russians just sent in some personnel, in fact, and Russia claims it's for maintenance work on military equipment, but it may be far more than that. I just have to ask you, though, about your assessment as a correspondent of the political situation there. I mean, the fact of the matter is that many people see Juan Guaido as being, you know, the rightful heir to leadership, and they see him as being on the left, but he's more to some extent on the right. He's got, for example, Bolsonaro of Brazil behind him.
That's right. No, it's interesting. Guaido is, you know, he's got very much has, you know, Colombia, Brazil, you know, the right-wing governments, so to speak, in Latin America. Certainly the United States is, you know, led the charge to back up Juan Guaido, the Trump administration. You know, John Bolton, Trump's senior advisor, nearly daily is tweeting about, you know, that Maduro must go. They've, you know, made sure that the Maduro government does not touch. They've, you know, basically threatened a swift and significant response if Guaido is arrested or harmed in any way. So he's got some, you know, powerful friends, but it hasn't seemed to turn the tides in Venezuela at this point. So
Scott Smith,
a saga that's got to play out so far.
I was just going to say, Scott Smith, again, is correspondent for the Associated Press based in Caracas. And good to have you with us. So thankful for you being with us this morning. Appreciate it. Good luck.
Yeah, thank you, Michael.
That's
Take care.
Scott Smith, and let me tell you who's going to join us for some more analysis of what's going on in Venezuela. Isaias Medina III is a former senior diplomat at the United Nations Security Council for Venezuela under Nicolas Maduro. He resigned in 2017 in protest of human rights violations, denouncing crimes against humanity at the ICC, and we welcome you to the program.
Thank you so much, Michael. I'm honored to participate, and I'm looking forward to a fruitful discussion.
Thank you. We will look forward to that indeed, along with you. And Gabriel Hetland is joining us for this discussion and analysis as well. Gabriel Hetland is Assistant Professor of Latin American, Caribbean, and U.S. Latino Studies at the State University of New York at Albany. He's working on a book presently called Making Democracy Real, Participatory Governance in Urban Latin America. Welcome, Gabriel Hetland.
Thank you very much, Michael. Pleasure to be with you.
Good to have you as well with us. And actually, let me just begin with you from a perspective of what we heard Scott Smith talking about, John Bolin constantly at least bringing to our attention the need to overturn Maduro. How likely is it, in your judgment, that the United States, without even casting this for or against, there are sanctions now. They're increasing the sanctions. The United States is trying, in fact, to bring international sanctions. How likely is it, do you think, or how possible is it that there will be military intervention of some kind? President Trump was rattling his sword about Venezuela. Your thoughts?
I think it's very hard to say. There's contradictory information that's coming out. Elliot Abrams, who's a special envoy to Venezuela for the Trump administration, last week announced that Article 187, which would be used by the National Assembly to authorize foreign intervention by the United States or another country, was not going to be activated at this time. But there's statements by Marco Rubio, by John Bolton, by Trump himself, continuously saying that U.S. military intervention is very much on the table. So I think it doesn't feel like it's an imminent possibility right now, but it really doesn't seem like something we can discount. And I think we can't, you know, leave the domestic political sphere of the United States out of this. Obviously, there's an election coming up in 2020, and it seems, you know, quite likely that Trump will be trying to use Venezuela as a wedge issue in Florida and more broadly. So I think that that will, you know, potentially play into whether intervention happens, and it could play into timing as well.
Well, in the meantime, I say, as Medina, we have this terrible ongoing humanitarian crisis and great suffering. And there's actually control of food now going on as a political weapon by the Maduro regime. Tell us about that.
Thank you so much, Michael, and also Gabriel. I think it's very important to look at the Venezuelan crisis in context. It's a multidimensional crisis with domestic, regional, and global implications. Right now, Venezuela has become the Syria of the Western Hemisphere. It has the same players, Russia, Iran, Turkey. And if you add China, they have the same objectives to undermine and offset Western values and interests. This is why the U.S. is so active in the issues. But we must look at that they also have include the placement of 20,000 proxy Cuban agents that have infiltrated the armed forces and other institutions, and also terrorist organizations taking charge of at least 40% of our territory. This is organizations like FARC, ELN, and 60 non-state actors, armed Hezbollah-trained militias terrorizing the civilian population and pillaging our natural resources. So you can see clearly the convergence between trans-regional organized crime and our terrorist organizations. This, of course, is a threat to regional peace and security. This is a proxy asymmetric warfare. The stage of what is happening is of concern of the whole region. That is why it's being discussed at the Security Council twice. It's also under the Security Council item of the maintenance of peace and security. But I would like to make my case in the most important priority of this crisis, which is the humanitarian aspect. So regarding this, the question what we're talking about is a question of intervention. So what is just intervention and what is unjust intervention? A case of just intervention is international humanitarian intervention with a clear humanitarian mandate and strict rules of engagements. We have celebrated 25 years after the Rwanda genocide recently. So the question still stands. Has the international community learned the lesson yet? Can the international community not recognize the risk of early atrocity crimes? We are ready to put this to the test, and the result in Venezuela, 3 hours away from Miami. As you know, Kofi Annan's responsibility to protect doctrine of 2005 was clearly motivated by atrocity crimes such as genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and crimes against humanity. And the crimes against humanity, as the one of these four atrocity crimes, have been clearly identified in the Rome Statute Convention of the ICC, of which Venezuela is a state party of. Six regional state parties of the ICC have forwarded the OAS Independent Panel of Experts report, which allege crimes against humanity committed in Venezuela, including what you just mentioned, the denial of humanitarian crisis or the systematic weaponization of starvation and medicine scarcity for social and political control as a crime against humanity.
Well, this has all been documented, and I'm glad that you've certainly brought it once again to our attention, because humanitarian aid is needed, and needed desperately. And I know your resignation had to do with the fact that you felt that the Maduro government lost its legitimacy in those 2017 shootings of students. But can you separate the humanitarian need that is necessary from intervention? You've got Noam Chomsky and a number of scholars, for example, who said the U.S. should simply stop interfering in any internal politics or trying to overthrow the Maduro government. So you move in humanitarian, and yet there's a political agenda there, isn't there?
I think this goes well beyond any political agenda. It's a humanitarian agenda. Look at these numbers. 2017 and 2018, at least 31,400 newborn babies. They were born and died for malnutrition.
No, forgive me. I agree with you fully on that. In fact, there's a new report by UNICEF that talks about a million children who need essential services and so forth. But what I'm asking is, can you separate humanitarian involvement or intercession from...
You must. You must separate it. You know, 500,000 Venezuelans, children, women, and men have already perished for this imposition of humanitarian crisis. It is the responsibility of the international community to step in what we call the global moral responsibility to prevent another Rwanda and another Kosovo. The trigger of R2P is not only imminent, It's an emergency. It's also legal, legitimate, and is justified.
And this would be like the Organization of American States, the Red Cross, and so forth, right?
Yes, I believe so. But if we go one step further, and the thing is, of course, there have been other R2P actions that are contradictory. But if we can improve R2P with new technological advances in areas such as, as digital information, algorithm forensic data, autonomous surveillance vehicles, just to technologically monitor through the OAS and the ICRC that the mandate for the humanitarian intervention is met at the highest standard of the United Nations for international humanitarian law and also for human rights. Now we're talking that we want to save millions of lives that are in peril. This is completely different agenda than our political agenda.
Let me go to Gabriel Hedlund on this. I'd like to get his response to what you just said. Professor Hedlund, please.
Sure. I differ in my opinion, and I think many people who are observers would differ strongly on a number of points. I don't think it's advisable or warranted to compare Venezuela's situation to Rwanda. I fully agree that there's a humanitarian crisis. I fully agree that the government has failed to acknowledge the severity of the crisis. Many times the government's failed to even acknowledge the crisis exists whatsoever. And I also would agree that the government bears primary responsibility for the crisis. However, to characterize the crisis as the complete responsibility of the Venezuelan government overlooks the actions of the domestic opposition, which is engaged in violent protests, including killing a man in 2017 who was just an innocent civilian who was a dark-skinned black Venezuelan who was called a Chavista. They've engaged in bombing of government infrastructures, of schools, of hospitals. The U.S. government has also engaged in sanctions for a number of years. This goes back to 2015 and then really kicking into gear in 2017, which is an important part of the crisis. The current sanctions, which went into effect in January of this year on the oil sector in Venezuela, have been utterly debilitating. So the current escalation of the humanitarian crisis is indeed, to a large extent, the responsibility of the Venezuelan government. But it's also, to a very important extent, especially this year, the responsibility very directly of the U.S. government. There's very clear mechanisms that we can see in terms of understanding how this is happening. The blackouts that happened in March and that have been continuing, unfortunately, over the last several weeks within Venezuela are obviously related to the U.S. sanctions because they have prevented the government from having sufficient amount of fuel to run backup generators and to prevent sort of the blackouts from continuing to get power back on. None of that denies the responsibility of the government for allowing the crisis to unfold, for failing to manage the electricity grid in proper ways, but it brings in other players. And doing so, I think, also points the finger at the hypocrisy of the U.S. And that sort of damages the assessment that the U.S. could actually play any positive role in the Venezuelan crisis. As we know, the U.S. is doing absolutely nothing to thwart rising authoritarianism in places like Saudi Arabia, Egypt, even in Brazil, other Latin American countries. And yet, in Venezuela, they continuously accuse the government, with some justification, of authoritarian tactics. But we have to sort of call out the double standard that we see, and we have to call out the U.S.'s own role in causing a lot of the suffering that's happening right now. So the idea that Venezuela is Rwanda doesn't make sense empirically. The situation in Venezuela is not nearly as bad as it was in Rwanda at the time, which is not to deny that there's a real crisis, which is not to deny that there's a profound crisis, but there's very important differences in terms of the severity of the crisis, but also in terms of the direct U.S. role. So that just means that the U.S. is playing a direct role in increasing suffering in Venezuela. It's frankly absurd, with all due respect, to talk about the U.S. playing a positive role in trying to resolve that crisis.
Now, let me go right to the heart of what you're saying, Professor Hedlund, and get a response from Isaias Medina. I mean, essentially, the sanctions are hurting. There's no doubt about that. But to what extent they're hurting? I mean, the U.S. sanctions, and as I said, they're trying to spread those and make them more international, is a real question here. And also, when we mention Guaido, are we mentioning also someone who is responsible for human rights violations, as Professor Hedlund suggested? And maybe the United States doesn't really have much moral authority here, I think is also what Professor Hedlund is saying. Your thoughts, Isaias Medina?
Yes. Thank you so much. And I appreciate my co-panelist, Gabriel, but I agree to disagree. We must look at what is happening. It's no different to use the weaponization of starvation or medicine scarcity that has caused the death of at least 500,000 Venezuelans. And I already told you about they're killing babies. They're killing babies as a mean for social and political control. This is no different than what happened in Rwanda and Kosovo when they're using machetes or they're using they're shooting people. They're still killing people, and it's a systematic persecution and systematic as a as a policy of the state to control the people through this apartheid system that they use an electronic card that if you're not within the electronic card, you will not get food, medicine. And now the control of the electricity and water is also part of the plan.
Now, this is all dreadful, but is it really as serious as Syria and Rwanda, I think, is the question.
Oh, it's even worse. It's even worse. If I may, just let me give you some figures. The economic crisis is a self-inflicted crisis. Why? Because of the interest of grand corruption. And I think we have to talk about this because at least 15 Marshall plans have been mismanaged during the Chavista period. The plans that only one Marshall plan reconstructed 18 nations, they have already lost it, mismanaged it, and stole it, mostly through exchange control, fraudulent schemes that have been already been trialed and confessed. Like, for example, the treasurer of Chavez, he confessed
to... He took over $1 billion in bribes alone, over $1 billion.
How can we blame U.S. sanctions? Please, U.S. has been helping like anybody else. These sanctions have been targeted and very smart against a certain regime officials for drug trafficking, human rights violation. They used also the economic system of the U.S. to launder their money.
Forgive me, Senor Medina. I want to give our listeners an opportunity to weigh in here. And we're going to cut things short, unfortunately, because we are going to talk about the resignation earlier of Kirstjen Nielsen, Homeland Security head. But we do want to hear your thoughts on Venezuela, and the crisis is worsening, it's deepening. United States weighing in on intervention options. Hear your thoughts and any questions you may have. You can join us now toll-free, and I invite you to do that. The number to call, 866-733-6786. Please feel free to be part of the program. Again, join us toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also be part of this program by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. Or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and post your thoughts there and your comments, any questions you might have as well. You can also, of course, tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, and you can join us by going to our website, kqed.org/forum. A quick response from you, Gabriel Hedlund, though, about what we just heard from Isaias Medina.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, I think it's really important to recognize the government's role, and I think that there's, members of the, U.S. left that have refused to do that and have sort of given the government a free pass, and I don't think we should be doing that. We should recognize the corruption that Isaias is correctly pointing to. It is, dramatic. It's very bad. It also exists in many other Latin American countries, and it's existed in Venezuela for decades and decades under many different shades of government, but it has continued to exist under Chavez and certainly under Maduro today. But I think I would still take a strong issue with the notion that the sanctions haven't increased suffering in Venezuela. And there's studies that the head of Torino Capital in New York City, Francisco Rodriguez, who had some roles in the National Assembly as a sort of economic advisor in the early 2000s, has a study a couple of years ago which shows in meticulous detail that the sanctions that were put into place in 2017 had a very dramatic impact on Venezuelan oil production. He compares oil production in Venezuela and Colombia in the year and a half after the sanctions went into effect, and he shows that Venezuela's oil production had been very sort of similar to Colombia's in the years before that, but Venezuela, after the imposition of those oil sanctions, dramatically decreased. So that shows very clearly that U.S. sanctions have indeed had an impact, and the fact that they were targeted against certain particular individuals is true, but somewhat irrelevant because...
Forgive me, Professor Edlin, we're coming up on a break, and when we return, we'll hear more from our listeners. Stay tuned. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Big questions looming about Venezuela and ongoing terrible humanitarian crisis going on there. It deepens, and the whole question about who should be politically in charge is all a part of it, but also basic divisions and strong divisions about questions of sovereignty and questions of humanitarian aid and what it ought to mean, especially in terms of intervention and how much of a role that intervention ought to be. Scott Smith joined us earlier from the Associated Press, a correspondent who's based in Caracas, and Isaias Medina is with us, former senior diplomat at the United Nations Security Council, Venezuela under Nicolas Maduro. He resigned, and resigned in protest of human rights violations. And Gabriel Hedlund is with us as well, assistant professor of Latin American, Caribbean, and U.S. Latino Studies at the State University of New York at Albany. And before we went to that break, which we had to go to, Professor Hedlund was talking about sanctions, and I have a listener who has a question about sanctions. Simon, join us. You're on the air.
Thank you very much for taking my call. Professor Hedlund, you said that the sanctions have resulted in shortage of fuel in the fuel-rich Venezuela. And it just, you know, as not a scholar, it just doesn't make sense to me. Would you clarify that, please?
Yeah, sure. It's a great question. And Venezuela, despite its abundance of oil and, petroleum products, imports lots of products. This has gone on for decades. And so one of the products that they have to import is fuel to run backup generators. Venezuela is not a sort of autonomous country in terms of its economic production. And so for basic things, it goes well beyond fuel. I mean, food is imported on a tremendous scale within Venezuela, many parts, many other things. So the basic point, which goes beyond fuel, is that the sanctions have very much decreased Venezuela's ability to buy products abroad, also to get debt abroad. And that has led to shortages of really critical implements, critical inputs into many, many productive processes and many essential services in Venezuela. Again, that doesn't deny the government's responsibility for mismanagement, but it points out the specific impacts of U.S. sanctions.
There's been abominable mismanagement. I think we can all agree on that, just like we agree on the terrible corruption that's going on. The real question is, and how deep the humanitarian crisis is, the real questions have to do with what can be done and what ought to be done. And let me get another caller on here, and that's you. GP, good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Mike. Hey, everybody. Honestly, everybody's got to look into the mirror and realize the truth of the matter is, while Trump is in office, it's not going to happen that the U.S. is going to intervene because he's not going to step on Putin's toes. You know, everybody knows that Trump is in Putin's pocket, so it ain't going to happen. U.S. is not going to intervene. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you for that opinion. On the other hand, here's Noel who writes, maybe people think an invasion would be easy, like George H.W. Bush's invasion of Panama, but our leaders can't be honest about invasion reasons for Venezuela. They have to say it's humanitarian. A lot of people are suggesting that this has a good deal to do with oil. Matt writes, could your hyperbolic guest please tell us the circumstances of who exactly is killing babies in Venezuela? This reminds me of the fake testimony in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq. We heard this act before. Isaias Medina?
Thank you so much. That's amazing. That's a great question. Well, if we look into the 2017 report from Caritas, they have actually looked at it, and they have declared the humanitarian emergency since 2017, the same humanitarian emergency that Human Rights Watch just last week was talking about in their report. So this is when we're talking about a solution, the idea is an international humanitarian operation that is a military operation other than war, which is it's used for natural or man-made disasters. Sadly, in Venezuela, it's an induced humanitarian crisis to maintain its power. And that when you talk about the babies, the problem is that the regime has already affected generations of Venezuelans due to starvation. Starvation because they mismanaged the money that was supposed to buy the food. And that is why we've had supermarkets empty for the last 3 years. This is not due to any U.S. sanctions. And because people could not buy or afford the food when there was some food, now mothers were giving birth when they were starving and their babies were starving. So think about that 80% of children under five are malnourished. Think about their generations to come. They will be affected by starvation.
Yeah, I think the listener was talking about Kuwait when I remember that whole controversy. They were babies in incubators who were ignored, and that was very, or at least that was the allegation. It was a very different situation, but yet babies are starving to death in Venezuela. I think the proof is there. I wanted to ask you, though, Medina, if I could, about Senator Menendez of New Jersey. Robert Menendez just got a bipartisan bill through, I believe. About $400 million is going to go in aid to Venezuela. That's twice what the original Republican proposal was. It should help, but there's kind of a rider to this bill. I mean, not literally a rider, but a rider in effect, saying that if that bill goes through, we definitely have to make sure that the Guaido leadership takes the place or supplants the Maduro leadership. Any thoughts from you on that?
Yes, I think that's a great point, and that 400 million is actually going to be short because we're talking about hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans that have been inflicted. The report talked about 650,000 people. I think it's way above that. Already 3.5 million have been forcibly displaced due to that situation. There's 600,000 cases of malaria, diphtheria, measles. People are dying just by any chronic disease. People are dying from diabetes. I want the American people to understand that because they're not able to buy insulin. They're dying. They are dying because any chronic disease, let's just call it a heart disease.
There's no dialysis. There's no cancer treatment.
There's no dialysis. I mean,
what happened to all those Cuban doctors who were stationed in Venezuela?
Well, I think that was part of the agreement, which was illegal because it never passed through our Congress. But that's how they infiltrated 22,000 agents, Cuban agents, into our armed forces and other institutions. So we don't need to worry about an invasion because Venezuela is already an invaded territory. What we're looking at our allies to work with us is to vacate these invaders. But even before that, what we need is to save hundreds, millions of lives by an international humanitarian intervention. It's the only human thing to do. It's moral, it's ethical, and it's by principle what the U.S. should be leading the charge for an international coalition to work with the OAS and the ICRC to bring humanitarian aid that it's needed.
Let me just ask, Gabriel Hedlund, you agree with that, at least to conclude?
No, and I think it's important to bring in that there are other options on the table now. There's dialogue and negotiation processes by European states, by Latin American countries. Uruguay and Mexico have floated and negotiated a sort of solution that hasn't had a lot of legs because the U.S. has been so opposed to that. There's also the International Contact Group, which is mostly European Union states, as well as a number of Latin American states, which the U.S. has not had a role in. So the idea that U.S. military intervention is, A, the only way to bring change within Venezuela, or B, a good way, I think is inaccurate. There are other options on the table. And if we look at cases...
But Senor Medina is separating humanitarian from military, I think. Can you separate
the
two?
If we look at... No, I mean, the U.S. is directly responsible for a good portion of the humanitarian suffering. They're causing billions of dollars in damage to the Venezuelan economy, and this is explicit. I mean, Marco Rubio, John Bolton know exactly what they're doing. They literally want to, quote-unquote, make the economy scream to lead to a popular uprising. So there's nothing surprising about what we're seeing now, but then to have them offer $400 million, which is a pittance compared to the amount of money that they're depriving the government of, just shows a hypocrisy. They're not truly interested in humanitarian aid to Venezuela. They're interested in regime change, period. I think the U.S. doesn't have a credible record. And so the presumption that the U.S. is a good guy in this situation is flat out wrong. It's false. The U.S. has showed over and over again in Latin America and in Venezuela that it doesn't really care about democracy, human rights, or humanitarianism. And I think that has to be accurate. That's just the facts on the ground if we actually closely look at what has happened in Latin American history, including recent history. The U.S. continues to support brutal regimes in Honduras, in Brazil, and elsewhere in Latin America, and that's happening right now. So we have to really look things in the face if we want to have an honest conversation about what's happening.
All right, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. I thank both of you for giving your points of view. We've been talking with Isaias Medina III, former senior diplomat for the United Nations Security Council for Venezuela, and Gabriel Hedlund, professor at the State University of New York in Albany. Stay with us.